Thank you for correcting me on the vocalist, too. I think I said Rick earlier. So we like to be accurate here at the R4 podcast.
No, we just like to prove you wrong.
Well, that's easy to do. At the point when I, during my rant, Jason, just put the word Benjamin over when I say Rick.
Benjamin.
Then, yeah. Yeah. Make it real.
I love
obvious.
The way Benjamin
sings the song.
Do it just like that.
That's right. Yeah. It'll be fine. Hello, I'm Jason Dantzis.
I'm Ian Rice.
I'm Sean Hillman.
And welcome to Ridiculous Rock Record Reviews, a podcast where we discuss and review a rock record of our choice. Today is our first R4 rerun, where we dip back into the catalog and pull up a record that's already been discussed. In this case, episode 17, where our fearless heroes, Aaron Martell and Sister Shannon, discussed the Cars debut from 1978. And we're going to revisit it today. And with us to do so is a special guest, the host of my weekly mixtape, Mr. Brian Colburn. Welcome to the podcast.
Gentlemen, thank you so much for bringing me on for this one. I'm really excited to be here.
So as mentioned, we're going to discuss the 1978 release from the Cars, their debut record. So, Brian, as our special guest, why don't you tell us about your history with the Cars and how you came across this record?
Well, this is, I'll just start by saying, my favorite record of all time. And the reason for that is this is the record that I remember most from my youth. When I was growing up, during the week, my parents were working. I had school. There was homework and all that. Every Friday night, I'll never forget, my father would turn the TV off right after Wheel of Fortune ended, and he would open up the record bin and start pulling out albums. And every Friday night, he let me stay up till like 10 o'clock. And to me, that was, when you're young, that's like a big deal, because normally 8 o'clock was bed, and it was, they were pretty strict about it, but Friday nights was the night, and he would just put on albums. And then slowly, as I got older, he would let me start picking albums and picking songs if I wanted to throw a Muppet song or an Alvin and the Chipmunks into the mix. But this album, they played so much, it basically became ingrained in my musical DNA, and to the point where the vinyl record they had a skip in Good Times Roll. And every time I listen to the song now and I don't hear the skip, it still sounds foreign to me, even though I've heard the song a million times since my childhood. So you could say I'm pretty psyched to go through this album track by track tonight.
I've always been a big fan of the Cars since I was in about junior high school. And a friend of mine, who was also a drummer in a band I was in, introduced me to the Cars, and it was so far out of left field as to what I was listening to at the time. But and I've always viewed the Cars' first album, I'm gonna say this right off the bat, as its own greatest hits album. And whereas every song can be a single, had the potential to be a single, and quite a few of them were, and they're staples on FM rock radio now. And it's just it's that kind of album, like Def Leppard's Hysteria, or you know, things of that nature, just, you know, designed to be its own greatest hits in a way. And I love it. And I've loved the Cars ever since I first heard them.
Well, first of all, let me say, Brian, you had a pretty good childhood there. those are pretty epic Friday nights. I am definitely on the other end of the spectrum with the Cars. I would say I have an awareness about them. I had an awareness of this album, but didn't listen to it in its entirety until April 11th, 2024. Which is the day that we're recording this episode. So I'm giving you a very, very fresh and probably somewhat uninformed perspective. But I think I like the band more now than I did about 4 hours ago. And we'll talk more about that.
Justification for coming in hot. It's fine. It's cool.
You guys give me a last minute assignment, so I can't be held responsible for anything that I say.
Sure. Yeah. All the fine print. Yeah, we got it. It's cool. So I'm going to tell you my gateway into this, as is most things. And I saw a lot of comments coming out of the Led Zeppelin episode we did about how my first gateway into Houses of the Holy was through the Encomium tribute album. Mm-hmm. Well, this is not any different. I'm a child of the 90s. I did not really start listening to rock music at all until the 90s. And so my gateway into this record is from another band who did a cover. And before you play your bingo chip, fellas, not the same band I usually talk about. My other favorite band from the Smashing Pumpkins. The Airplane Flies High. Does he turn left and look right or turn right and look left? I can't remember. Bullet with Butterfly Wings. The single, except for it wasn't really a single. It was like a mini EP. It came out in a box set that came out in 1996. And one of the tracks on there was a cover of You're All I've Got Tonight. And that's how I got into this band, because I listened to that track and several other of the covers that are on there. And I thought to myself, well, any time when I hear a cover, I always want to know, like, where did this come from? Like, obviously it was inspired to a point where this band decided to cover this song. So I want to understand what the original sounded like. So I always go back to whatever that original song was. But that's how I came to this record, is pursuing that cover. It's going to be a theme throughout the history of us doing this podcast. So like, I discovered all these old 70s, 80s bands, et cetera, through 90s covers. It's just how it's going to be. Sorry. That's how it goes. All right, let's get into the background of this band. So The Cars is the debut album by American new wave band The Cars, released June 6, 1978 on Elektra Records, produced by Roy Thomas Baker, reached at number 18 in the U.S. Billboard 200 albums chart, certified 6 times platinum by the RIAA. Let's look at the personnel that's on this record. We have Rick Ocasek on vocals, rhythm guitar. We have Elliot Easton, lead guitar, backing vocals. Benjamin Orr, vocals, bass. David Robinson, drums, percussion, syndrums, and backing vocals. Greg Hawks on keyboards, percussion, saxophone, and backing vocals. If you want to know where I got that, you can probably guess it was Wikipedia. Yeah. All songs were written by Rick Ocasek, with one exception. There is a song that is written by both Rick and another gentleman. We'll talk about that when we get there. So we open the record with Good Times Roll.
God, what a way to start off a band's discography. I talk about this all the time on my weekly mixtape. I'm a sucker for a good album opener that's going to draw you in and really give you an idea about what it is you're about to hear on this album, the journey you're about to embark on. And the opening guitar riff of Good Times Roll is the perfect introduction, because the song builds into this kind of swagger that they duck and weave out of for the rest of the album. And it's something that, for me, it's very hard to listen to any individual song on this album when it comes up randomly on a playlist that I've created, because when I hear it, I want to hear it in context of the album. So I could say right off the bat, there's been many a times where Good Times Roll comes up on random on a playlist and I'm like, go to album, we got to keep going. This song, believe it or not, it always shocks me because it was such a radio staple. I heard it at my parents' house growing up all the time, like I had mentioned. Always heard it on the radio. Shocked it never was a top 40 hit. It only reached number 41. So when you think about it, yes, it was a hit, but it wasn't top 40. So that sometimes could be a real driver for a band. And this one's been covered. Jason, I know you talk about your cover songs. In 1999, Power Man 5000 covered it on Tonight the Stars Revolt. And in 2020, Warrior Soul covered it on their album Cocaine and Other Good Stuff. So, I mean, that's two different vibes, two different takes on the song. But to me, you can't get a better start than this one.
I totally agree that this is a great way to open the album. And the guitar tone on this is fantastic. And it sets the bar high for the rest of the album. But the album, as we'll find out, doesn't have much of a hard time keeping up. But it also sets the standard for what the Cars are all about. And one thing that they're very, very adept at is dropping in little ear candy here and there throughout the song. And particularly in this one, when he hits the lyric, "Let them leave you up in the air, let them brush your rock and roll hair," which is a fantastic lyric, by the way. But there's like little keyboard parts behind that. Those are the memorable things of these songs, and they're like masterful at it. And I was thinking about it today. I don't know if there was anybody that kind of did the synth power pop kind of thing in rock like the Cars did before them. So they're kind of pioneers in a way. And this is your introduction to their pioneering. It's a fantastic tune.
I also think that's a nod to Roy Thomas Baker's production, because the layers on this album is something where this is a headphone album. When you listen to it with headphones on, you get immersed in this production and in this sound. It's not just right down the middle where the band is cranking in front of you. There's little subtle nuances of where the tones happen, and it really engulfs you in the music. It's masterful production as far as I'm concerned.
Well, Brian just read all my notes that I have on the screen. So, good thing. This sets the tone for what to expect with the album. Steady, clean guitar pick and the rest of the band's coming in layer upon layer, including a tasty undertone of fuzzy synth organ that dances back and forth with partners in the bass guitar as well as the lead. Starting at about 28 seconds in, it does its own thing until about a minute five when it mirrors the bass line. Then at 19 seconds later, he switches partners and does guitar interplay, and the same thing happens throughout the song. I became so obsessed with this instrumentation in preparing for the show, I nearly forgot to see what I could make of the lyrics. I like the throw your cares to the wind attitude here. Rock out. Enjoy yourselves tonight. Worry about tomorrow. Or don't. And for fuck's sake, don't worry what anyone else thinks. Rick Ocasek was already a dinosaur by rock standards of the day at 34 years old, but it serves him well here, as even though it's a new band, they speak with gravity and experience. A banger of an opener.
All right. So much for you coming in unprepared.
Yeah. See what I do when I have time.
There you go. Yeah, so this track came in. This was the third single released from the record. B-side was All Mixed Up, which we'll talk about in a little bit. What's interesting about this is this introduces the world to, I guess, what you would call the genre of new wave, right? The combination of the keyboard stuff, the guitar stuff, the way that it all comes together. The one thing that I personally don't like, and I'll put it on the table now and then I'll get over it, is I feel like the vocals are always over enunciated. We're going to hit all the vowels and all the consonants of it, and it's a little much for me. But at that being said, obviously when I put this record on, I've heard this before, I know what it is. The guitar stabs are phenomenal. I love the backing vocals that come in the chorus. This is another thing that'll be a staple of this band. It's like a call and response all the time. It's vocal and then response from the keys, or vocal and then there's a keys and response from the guitar. They all interplay with each other. It's a super nice groove. Obviously a very familiar song. If you're going to put this on and play the record, You're going to know this right away. Like almost from the first guitar chord you hear, you know what the song is. And so here we go on what is essentially a debut record that's full of greatest hits. That is a rare accomplishment. You know, there's a lot of other bands that we could say the same thing for, but for this particular record for the Cars, I think we're going to end up with spoiler alert. I think there's 6 songs on this record that have charted. And this is one of the greats that comes right out of the gate. So that brings us into the next track, which is My Best Friend's Girl.
Always dancing down the street with the sway blue eyes. Every new boy that you meet, he doesn't know the real surprise.
Here she comes again.
She used to be mine. I can't help my little self. I think I mean this is like a 1-2 punch with Good Times Roll. It's another fantastic tune, and it actually introduces for me, which is very, you know, thinking back on it, almost very Queen-like in a way. But the way that their background vocals are layered, they're very full sounding. Again, you know, credit to the production on this, and also, and I didn't mention it on the top, but the drum sound on this record is fantastic. For at times, you know, often sounds a little, you know, synth drums, you know, maybe a little too processed, but you can never get by the fullness of the bass drum on this, and just the room it was recorded in. There's a lot of room to breathe for the drums, and it really lays a great foundation for most of the songs. But this is one of those songs that everybody knows, and it's just this is like woven into my teenage years, and I can never there's so much associated with this song for me in terms of memories that it'll always be a favorite of mine.
Well, another opener with a hooky guitar riff. This time we get hand claps to open up the song as well, before Rick Ocasek gives us a song that made a career for Rick Springfield. Don't tell me he didn't directly rip this off to make Jesse's Girl. I hope he paid royalties. The song is catchy, and as Ian said, it's a 1-2 punch. I think we're 2 for 2 so far.
First thing I want to do is respond to Ian, because he had mentioned there's almost a Queen sound to the production. And it's interesting you mention that, because Roy Thomas Baker produced all of Queen's albums up through Jazz.
Oh, is that right?
And he also produced, yes, and he also produced the Cars album. So that might be where that connection actually makes sense. Because he brought the Queen elements in the layering of the vocals and everything else. It is from the mind of Queen's producer. This one did crack the top 40, reach number 35, not the highest charting single from the album, but it was the second single, top 40 hit. So no complaints there. Jason, in your 90s style, Nirvana covered this.
Yes, it did.
During their final concert ever in Munich. And if you're a fan of bluegrass, Hasey Dixie covered the song on their 2002 album, A Hillbilly Tribute to Mountain Love. Interesting version. I actually love Hasey Dixie. They're ridiculously talented. But this song to me always had this 1950s flair to it. Mm-hmm. Yes, the guitar, like, you know, Sean had mentioned the hand claps. To me, it feels like they recorded it in the church in the 1950s, a la That Thing You Do. It has that vibe to it, that throwback sound, that almost innocence to the music that is offset by the lyrics, which at the time is a little bit more forward thinking. I mean, lyrics like you've got your nuclear boots and your drip dry glove, and when you bite your lip, it's some reaction to love. That's pretty damn poetic. I love this track. What a great track too.
Backing vocals show up here and are prominent. And are the best part of the song, in my opinion. And that little guitar figure, every time they sing the vocal, "She Used to Be Mine," and it's that little, like I, you said, like the 50s style, like it's a little doo-wop kind of style. And then that goes right into, at 2 minutes, that solo figure that's also pretty 50s little doo-wop style solo, which is really cool. And then the hand claps that are in there. Obviously, I've heard this song several times. It's a staple. And to me, like, what I start to realize is this record, to me, almost has three sections. Even though it's a, if we think of it as a actual vinyl record, there's two sides. And side two is its own definitive thing, which we're going to talk about. But the first side of the record has two sections for me. The first section is the first three tracks, which are the ubiquitous, well-known things. And then we have two tracks that are like, okay, those are the deep cuts. And then we flip the record over and it's this whole beast. So we're midway through the section that I believe is like, oh, I remember hearing that song, but I never realized it was on this record. And it's a pretty good song. Which brings us to the next track, which is Just What I Needed.
It should be clear now that the Cars like to open songs gradually. Hooky guitar riffs. Are hooky guitar riffs in 3 minute and 44 second songs getting old? Maybe, but maybe not. This song is so simple, it's complicated. We start with eighth notes in a rhythm guitar that lay the foundation for the entire song, then snare drum, then bass, then vocals, then another guitar, then a tom fill, then keys. The way they introduce each layer of the band and balance the dynamics is a chef's kiss lesson in sound engineering. And I knew nothing about the engineer before listening to this, but it stood out to me from the moment I laid it down. It's funny. It's almost with this song, like the band said, all right, let's do what we did with My Best Friend's Girl, but do something completely different. And instantly everyone understood the assignment. After the chorus and a short but sweet guitar solo, you join the second verse at about 2 minutes in. The band throws a cute little change up, not once but twice in the verse, when the snare changes from beats 2 and 4 to 1 and 3. I'm partial to this song. I like Benjamin Orr on vocals. We played this one in my cover band, and it's a fun one when you have talented players that know what they're doing. Despite me being in the band, we pulled it off, and it was always a hit live, except you can't really dance to it, but that's okay.
Despite you being in the band.
Oh, yeah.
He's so self-deprecating.
It was four talented musicians and me. It was a good time.
Well, we got the album's first single here, and believe it or not, it's Benjamin Orr on lead vocals, like Sean said, the first time he's appearing on the album. It wasn't until I was actually old enough to read that I realized the Cars had two lead singers. even hearing Candio and Panorama, I just assumed, because tonality wise, both Rick and Ben have a similar delivery and a similar tone to their voice. And I am sure there's somebody out there that's maybe learning right now that the Cars have two lead singers, because they're so close. It's not to the point of like a Kiss where, you know, hey, that's Gene Simmons and now that's Paul Stanley. There's a definitive difference. Or Beth, there you go. There's Peter Criss or New York Groove by Ace. This is a little different. And to me, this is the song that they named their greatest hits album after this, that came out on Rhino in the 90s. This is their bread and butter. It's a great song. And I love the fact that Sean referenced the 3 minute and 44 second mark, because that was something I remember staring at the platter. I was like, man, these guys are really good at hitting that 3:44 mark for this one. But yeah, nothing but great things about this song.
I absolutely love this song for many, many reasons. I love the way it starts just with that little guitar strum and then the guitar and snare hitting at that time. It's just like kind of jolts you out awake if you were kind of not paying attention. But I always have a very, very special memory of this song, and that's why it will forever be intertwined into my musical listening. Is again, same friend I was talking about. Unfortunately, he passed away a few years back. He was a drummer, so he would always point out to me the drum roll that leads into this song. And it actually was the first time I ever appreciated something for its simplicity. Because when you first get into music, especially if you're like, I was a guitar player at the time, so you gravitate to the things that are fast and impressive. But really, over time, then that's when you come to learn that sometimes less is more. And appreciate how simple things can really make or break a song. And that was the first time I learned that lesson, was hearing that, just that drum roll. It really does. It's such a signature part of the song, much like the keyboards are, like those keyboard lines that are behind everything. Those are key parts of the song. When you think of the title of the song, those are the things that kind of pop into your head. So this song will always be very special to me for those reasons.
Yeah, this is the first time we get Ben Orr on vocal. So one thing that I noticed that was strange, and if I were in my OCD world of sequencing, Ben Orr has one vocal take on the first side, this track. Rick Ocasek has one vocal take on the second side. And in my OCD world, I would have had all Ben Orr on one side and all Rick Ocasek on the other side. That would be my thing. So what's really cool about this is there's a lot of nice stabs and chugs. So the thing that people think of most with new wave is obviously keyboards and all of the synthesizers and introducing that. But this song, and several others we'll talk about later, don't forget this is a guitar record too. The guitarist on this album is really phenomenal. And there's a lot of amazing riffs. There's a lot of good little fills that are in here. And sometimes it's easy to overlook Elliot Easton and all the work that he does. Elliot Easton is not a name that you hear commonly amongst great guitars of the 70s, right? Because, I mean, obviously there's a ton of great guitars in the 70s. But as you move through this record and you hear these riffs and you listen to all these different fills, Elliot Easton he's solid. He knows what he's doing. In and amongst all of the keyboard new wavy stuff. And this song is no slouch. And I love how the verse builds up. Like there's this continual build in tension. And then this is probably the first time, even though I've heard the song a million times, as I was listening to it to prepare for this, I was like, this guitar solo rips. We'll talk about the song that I got into this when we get there. And it's a guitar song. But I didn't expect, I thought that would be an anomaly. And as I went through this record and I started listening, yes, obviously the keys and everything that's happening with the synths and all that new wavy stuff is there. But this is a guitar rock record, even with that. Hats off to Elliot, because he caught my attention that this is a bigger guitar rock record than I thought it was going to be. All right, so that brings us to the next song, which is I'm in Touch with Your World.
You get the fork and you get
to go on a limb and say that this is going to be a divisive track amongst this discussion tonight. And I can understand why. This is a spacey, weird, synth-heavy song that shows a little bit of the band's, I'll just say, weird side. Greg Hawkes is in complete control, laying in this synth foundation over the lyrics. This is one of the headphone songs I was talking about. When you listen to this song on headphones, there's a lot going on. And it paints a really amazing musical picture. However, I can understand why this was a B-side and not released as a single. It's probably too weird for rock radio. I just couldn't picture this album without it.
Now the R4 podcast presents our weekly segment, Shawno coming in hot.
Here he comes.
All right, seriously, let's start with what's good here. I guess if you like percussion and gibberish and a song that sounds like you let a fourth grade class take some mushrooms and break into a music studio with a herd of cats, this is about what you could expect to hear. So, points for accuracy, I suppose. Did I hear a fucking referee whistle in there? For the nonsensical farce that was the instrumentation, at least there was percussion and a lot of creativity. There, I found something nice to say. This is less rock band and more like the Oompa Loompas sing new wave karaoke. Listen to it with a quality pair of headphones, like Brian said, and at least appreciate the production. Or never listen to it again, like I won't. Take your pick. And that was Shawno coming in hot.
Brought to you by Insert.
Brought to you by Xanax.
We need a hot sauce or a Percocet sponsor to insert in right here. That'd be good. Brian, I'm really a nice guy in person, I swear.
Oh.
Don't believe his lies.
This is the Cars self-titled quote-unquote ballad in all of its weird glory. And it's a dip in the album's kind of sonic landscape where it's not heavy. So it gives you something to kind of palate cleanse before the punk rock assault of the next track. So I kind of, yeah, it's weird and it's crazy, but it still makes sense to me. It's probably because I'm just such a stan for the album, but
I hope to get where you are someday, but I ain't there yet.
I can understand if it's your first time hearing it, why you would think the way you did though. So
it may be my last, but there's hope. We'll see. Ian, where are you? Are you Switzerland on this?
No, but I will say to your point, this is the first thing that popped in my head when you said about it being school kids playing it. I thought of like when Jimmy Fallon does like,
yeah,
songs played on kids' instruments, and I thought Metallica doing Enter Sandman that way. But I kind of, this song's interesting to me in the context of the album, kind of like what Brian was saying, in that it's like, all right, guys, we just had like three like rock standards, like single worthy songs. Let's go Frank Zappa on this now. Let's get weird. And but there is something that kind of sticks in your head about the main riff, if you will. Like the guitar goes down and then climbs back up. There's something very catchy about it, but it is also very kind of childlike in a way. So actually, Sean, even though you're trying to be all hot and bothered, it is very accurate in saying that. But overall, in the context of the album, I think it's a song that belongs, and I can deal with it, and it does prove wrong when I said right at the top that every song could be a single. This definitely couldn't be a single, but it still works. I agree with Brian.
Did somebody say it was a B-side?
It is.
Just what I needed.
There you go.
You need Wikipedia.
Yeah, you've got a human Wikipedia for this album sitting right there.
I have more copies of this album between the original Japan CD, the vinyl LP. I have the gold disc version, the deluxe edition. If they released like a different deluxe version every year, I would probably be like, okay, I need that too.
So Rick Ocasek should probably name his beach house the Brian Colburn Estate.
Yeah, at least a part of it. Maybe one of the bathrooms.
So here's what my notes say. Lots of noise, percussion, bells, triangles, a slide whistle, a real whistle. Did Mario just get a mushroom? Did he just upgrade to a fire flower?
Yes.
I don't know what's happening here, but it reminds me that I probably need to go play with some Nintendo. That brings us to the next track. Don't Just Stop.
Okay, but seriously, after that last head trip, we're back to some rock. I was not familiar with this song before listening to it today, and it didn't take long for it to grow on me, an up-tempo toe-tapping rocker. It's funny you mentioned Queen earlier, and I didn't know about the producer. I came away wondering what this would have been like if Queen had created it rather than the Cars. That's not a knock on the Cars so much as it's a nod to Roger Taylor, because this sounds like one of his concoctions that Freddie would have absolutely slayed. This is going to be one that I go back to often. I like this track.
I agree with Sean. This is kind of after that little detour. This is like they come back like real heavy and frantic, and it's an interesting way to close out the side. You know, short, quick, 3 minute little number. Sometimes I will admit, depending on when I'm listening to it, the repetition of the chorus sometimes it's like pummels you, you know. But overall, I like this track. Not necessarily one of my top ones on the entire album, but you know, it again works with the flow of not only the first side but the album as a whole entity.
The Cars are a new wave group that incorporates all different sounds and styles. And Don't You Stop is the Cars incorporating 70s punk rock into their sound. And they do it so effortlessly to slide out of the psychedelic weirdness of I'm in Touch with Your World. It's such a 180. It almost, you feel like a musical human pinball going from those two songs. But it really makes Don't You Stop close the album side out on a heavy note. Because you've got that dip after the first three songs with the weirdness of I'm in Touch with Your World. And this goes, no, 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 we're still here. We got it. Let it come on back. And this is the song to pummel you into side B. And side B is such a statement in and of itself. I know, Jason, you had said you would have flip-flopped the songs, but I just can't, because side two to me is an absolute masterpiece. And the sequencing on this album, I think, was perfect, because I think in agreement, I'm in Touch with Your World. If everybody was to rate this album like a Records Revisited rating of low score to high score, I'm guessing a lot of ones would be thrown on I'm in Touch with Your World, understandably so. But Don't You Stop is a great side closer, and it kind of cleanses your palate for what's to come.
So Don't You Stop. So first of all, ooh, and then the snare hit to go into it. Love that. Very cool. Up-tempo groove. We needed that. I think that was needed after the last weird song that we got. The vocal call and responses with the guitar. I think the choruses are a little bit too repetitive, but they have nice little guitar solos or little guitar figures that are at the end of each bit going into each verse. I love the drums heading into the second chorus. I love all the tom fills. To me, at 2:25, the solo that happens right there is great. Don't like that it fades out, but if we're ending a side and we're going to flip it and we're going to get ready to enter into a new sort of I know a lot of people talk about, and I guess we'll just seg right there. Sorry, don't you stop. I'm going to move on from you already. When we flip the record and we start with the next track, the four tracks on the second side to me are all one track.
Yep.
I know a lot of people talk about the last three tracks in particular, but I think it really starts with You've All I Got Tonight. As I look at side one versus side two, side one, the only Benjamin Orr vocal is just what I needed. Side two, the only Ocasek vocal is going to be the first song on side two, which is You're All I've Got Tonight. So imagine a world where Just What I Needed segged into Bye Bye Love, segged into et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That could still work if they did it right.
The one thing I would say is Just What I Needed and Bye Bye Love have a similar BPM where there's almost the kind of vibe where going from You're All I've Got Tonight with those thunderous tribal drums, switching into the power pop brilliance of Bye Bye Love is, it really creates this kind of interesting transition that I think might not be as pronounced if you come out of the similar vibe of Just What I Needed.
All right. Okay. All right. Well, we'll get there. We're going to get there.
Sorry.
We're going to get there in a minute. Yeah. No, I love it. Good. This four track sequence on the second side is one four track movement. And it starts with You're All I've Got Tonight.
I mean, this song's almost primal. It's great the way it starts. I love the, and I forgive me, I don't know what the effect is called, but there's a clear effect on the drums where they sound like they're kind of underwater and then not
flanging. You know,
flanging. Thank you. I knew it was in there somewhere. But this is just a fantastic track. And I was going to bring up that the Smashing Pumpkins covered it, and stupidly, not even I thought, like, oh, nobody will know that, and then I forgot Jason's here and he knows everything about the 90s, and but that's a very faithful cover as well. But you know, the source material, even though it's got a little bit of a darker edge to it on this track, it's still like these guys are masters of like pop rock, and I mean that in the nicest way possible, because sometimes that term can be almost derogatory, but these guys know how to hook you in but still keep things like dirty and gritty, and it's a weird marriage that the very few bands can pull off, and the Cars are really masterful at it.
Well, I am so glad that you brought up the Pumpkins version, because when I first heard that, I immediately had to go out and buy it. And as much as I love the Pumpkins cover on that box set CD single, David Robinson's flange drowned drums are untoppable. It's weird to say that the Cars version is heavier than the Smashing Pumpkins, because the Smashing Pumpkins version, I think that the one thing that bothers me about it is the drums are so dry, it almost strips an element of heft from it, where that thunderous do, 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 you don't feel that. It almost sounds like he's hitting drums that have like kind of socks over them. And the guitars are heavier in the Smashing Pumpkins version, but overall the song is heavier on the Cars album. I'm going to say something that might make you just throw me off the Zoom right now, but I would have been very interested to hear Smashing Pumpkins cover I'm In Touch With Your World, because there's something about Billy Corgan's vocals that I could actually hear working I don't know why. It's a lovely way to go. I could hear Billy singing that. And it's obvious he's a fan of this band and this album, but I digress. This is a classic rock staple. And as far as I'm concerned, when you drop the needle on side two, it's one song. David Robinson's drums ends with Greg Hawk's saxophone solo, and it's one movement.
That if this was on the Perfect Album Sides podcast, it'd be a short episode because it's right there. Is that Pumpkins version live? Is that a live cover that they
did? Studio.
No. I was going to say, if Jimmy Chamberlain couldn't reproduce what they did with the production on the drums, I would get it, but I guess he has no excuse. All right, I have H-E-A-V-Y. All right, some drums to open a song. Heavy guitars and heavy vocals and heavy drums and heavy breaks. Sing this ode to dysfunctional relationships. Yes, sometimes lust wins over love, kids. Sex feels good. Sorry, not sorry. After the first verse, then again a little after 3 minutes in there, there's some bitching guitar solos to put a bow on the song. However, in one of the rare moments of the album, aside from the one song, that I didn't appreciate, the layering. There's percussion quarter notes over the top of those solos. And then, not to be outdone, too much organ. It's annoying. Take that shit out of there like you did in the middle main solo at about a minute 54, and you have a great song overall. It's still good, but there were a few strikes in this at bat.
Let me just say a couple things. First of all, I don't think the problem with the Pumpkins cover is Jimmy Chamberlain. I think he does great. I think he recreates the tribal beat element of this just fine. If I were to tell you what the problem is with the cover, it's the guitar work. Because when you listen to this original versus the cover, all of the cover stuff is very derner, derner, and there's no life in it. Whereas if you listen to the original, the guitar work with all the little fills and stuff they do after the different vocals and stuff is a much more lively guitar. The original is far more interesting from a guitar standpoint. In fact, on this record, as a new wave record, which is this sort of synthesis between keyboard and guitar rock type of situation, this is probably the heaviest guitar rock song on the entire record. This is guitar rock right here with all the little fills that they have after each verse, the little slide riffs that come in, particularly in the chorus. When you come out of the second verse, all the little guitar fills that happen after each vocal bit, that you don't get that in the cover. That's what surprised me when I went back and listened to the original and all the little guitar fill elements that they do after each. It's like a call and response almost with the vocals. So 155, Sean, you called this timestamp out. That's when the solo comes out and it goes into the verse and all the little guitar licks that goes into the chorus that comes out of at 305. That 2 minute stretch from 155 to 305 into the solo that segs out of the song, that's probably the best 2 minutes of this entire record, in my opinion.
It's good. Oftentimes bands will do that where they're layering and it works. And for the most part in this record, it does work for me, but those three guitar solos in one song works for this song, except they're throwing too much shit on top of it in those other two spots. But you're right. That minute 55, that solo that's there, I think is a top highlight of the whole record.
Amen. Which then drops into a spacey little keys part that segs right into the next track, which opens with a little flourish, and we get into Bye Bye Love.
What a way to start a song. Finally, we get a proper organ and guitar interplay between the lines. I don't care for the Bye Bye Love chorus, but the verses are great lyrically. Highlights for me included the organ solo at 2:15. It's beautiful, albeit too short. Bye, bye love. I like how after this, the second verse is revisited, but with a little more spit and vinegar. Benjamin's growl here makes me feel it. Whereas Temptation wins in the last number, he's got his arm out this time saying, "Hold on, Jezebel, you're wearing me out. I'm not like your other playthings, and I'm not taking this BS anymore. You're pretty, but you're pretty exhausting too." I like a little spit and vinegar in my music once in a while.
You always got to take it dirty, don't you, Sean?
We didn't even touch on the implied dirtiness of "Here Comes My Girl."
Don't, let's not talk dirty, but I'm about to talk about this.
Ian's mom might be listening.
Yeah. No, she doesn't listen to me. She's sick of my shit years ago. But this is actually my favorite Cars track out of any of their records. I think this song's almost perfect. I would like to mention up at the top, though, for years, when he says, "It's just a broken lullaby," I always thought he was saying it's just a fucking alibi. And I was like, I don't know what that means. But I mean, for years, I just, so.
Either one works.
Yeah. But it makes much more sense, the proper lyric. I just think this is as I had mentioned about the song prior, but this is the perfect example of merging that gritty rock with the power pop, more synth elements together. And, you know, Benjamin Orr's vocals, just wonderful. And there's a particular part in this song when he's singing "It's an Orangey Sky." There's just lilting little keyboards behind that. And it's so perfect. This song is almost a perfect song to me. And really, if anybody ever mentions the Cars, my mind immediately goes to Bye Bye Love. And if shockingly, on a lot of their early greatest hits packages, it was not included on it. It always pissed me off because, you know, I wanted it on there. But yeah, great song.
I think Ian and I just became best friends. I mean,
awesome.
This is my favorite Cars song as well. Favorite song on the album. This is power pop perfection. Elliot Easton's guitar solo in this song is so perfect. Got this almost 50s-esque style with a little bit of a, I don't want to say rockabilly flair, but there's something going on that he's kind of incorporating different styles of playing into this song. And you can't tell if it's not as 50s as My Best Friend's Girl, but there's definitely elements of the old style of rock and roll that he's bringing into the quote unquote modern era in 1978. Obviously, Benjamin Orr's vocals, my favorite lyric from The Cars is in this song, substitution, mass confusion, clouds inside your head. And like Sean said, at the third verse where he hits it like extra high with it, you could just feel the piss and vinegar in the delivery. Alkaline Trio covered this in 2000 on a 7-inch single, if you're a punk fan. And I could see where they got the inspiration, because this also brings a little bit of the punk flair from Don't You Stop into the power pop, but it doesn't overdo it, because if you drive this one too heavy into the punk, you lose the heft of the lyrics. So I think they found the perfect balance on this one.
Not only does Ben Orr have a great vocal on this, but this to me is his best bass work too.
Oh God. Yeah.
Right. This is like the little flourishes that come in at the ever. I wish I could do it, but like, at the end of each little chorus bit and at the end of each little verse bit, there's a little like, he just accents it, you know, and it's awesome. I love it.
Almost funky. It's almost funky.
Yeah. A little bit of funk. Yeah. I like it. A
little bit, but not enough to take you out of the power pop mindset. So it's a lot of stuff coming together.
Yeah. I totally dig it. Now, from my personal opinion, I don't like the super talky vocal. That's not a thing that kind of rubs me the wrong way, but it doesn't detract from how much I like the track. So like it works for this particular style that they're going for. I like how the pre-chorus keys come in. I like all the key solos. I like the chorus guitar riff and the little drum fills. I like how there's sort of a call and response in the verse between the vocal and the keys. It's like the vocal goes and then the keys go. Vocals go and then the keys go. And that gradually gets more intense as the song carries through. And then the last minute of the song, for me, is the best part. Nice guitar solo. And then it kind of ends in the same sort of dramatic fashion that it started with, right? So like it comes in all, and then it ends all, and then all of a sudden space that out into the soundtrack of our childhood, Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
Wait, that movie had sound?
It did. It did. Don't just look at the red bikini. There was an actual song that was playing during that scene. And it was called Moving in Stereo.
Life's the same. I'm moving in stereo. Life's the same, except for my shoes. Life's the same. Shaking like tremolo, like the same, it's all inside you.
I think you covered why this song would be very popular on a lot of people our ages list, but honestly, musically, to be serious for a moment, this is my headphone anthem from this album. Where I'm in Touch with Your World is fun to listen to because there's a lot going on and you can kind of get lost in it. That almost feels like something that would be more akin to like listening to a Pink Floyd song where you're just kind of listening for nuances. But Moving in Stereo, the panning and Roy Thomas Baker's production, it really is painting a picture in your ears that if you close your eyes, besides picturing Phoebe Cates, you're also hearing picturing a lot of music happening here. I know it's hard. You have to look past it for a second, but when you get past it, there's a lot going on in this song, and it's so perfect. And coming out of the joy of Bye Bye Love from that power pop, it's the weird song on this side, but by far it's the better weird song on the album by leaps and bounds.
Listening to this makes me want to invest in some of my friend Brian's space cookies. Another fun one to listen to with headphones, as Brian just said. The instrumentation and sound dynamics are really fun here and really well done. Did the producer play with the balance fader maybe a little too much? Sure, but it was the 70s. Anyone remake this song recently? That's actually a serious question. I feel like it would do really well today, perhaps even better than when it first came out. I can hear The Weeknd or somebody like that singing this today and it charting.
Fu Manchu covered it, I want to say, in 2007, but that's more of a punky take on it. So it's not going to have the trippy style that you're talking about, like the gotcha. Cars version.
Well, if anybody out there is listening, you have an assignment.
Jesus, doesn't anybody knock anymore? Man, this is... I mean, this track will always be iconic for that. But really, you know, to a similar point you were making, Brian, aside, even... divorcing it from that, this is such an interesting song. Again, the keys just throwing in these little tidbits of great stuff over this. That intro riff is just fantastic on the guitar. It's very underrated. I'd be honest with you, for up until this evening, I always thought this was Rick Ocasek singing this song. But it's very atmospheric. It's a stark contrast coming off of Bye Bye Love, but I think it ultimately works. And to everybody's point that this is kind of like one long song, this side, the change from something like Bye Bye Love into Moving in Stereo doesn't seem jarring. And that's a real credit to the Cars as a unit, because they can do something like that and have it be almost seamless. I mean, this is fantastic. And it's one of those songs, I've brought this up on other podcasts and other album discussions, I almost don't want to hear one song without the other. Like if I hear Bye Bye Love, I need Moving in Stereo right after it. So it's kind of cool that they compare two very different songs like that and have them be essential together.
When I ripped my CD, I actually ripped 7, 8, and 9 together.
Yeah.
Because I can actually forgive if You're All I Got Tonight's not in the 4 a little bit. But when I start hearing Bye Bye Love, there has to be a saxophone solo. And It's an 11-minute song as far as I'm concerned, but You're All I Got Tonight. It's a perfect, perfect album side, really. There's no...
Yeah, just like side two of Abbey Road. That's one song.
Yeah,
this
exactly.
is the new wave Abbey Road. You nailed it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sean, coming in with the best remark of the evening, I think.
You know, even a broken clock is right twice a day.
All right, so my take, yeah, I love it. Spacey, the nice riff that comes in. Builds in with various percussion elements. This is probably the song that most feels a little robotic, almost. If there was a song that sounds a little bit fakey, but this is before the time where that was even a thing. Like there wasn't digital processing. So the fact that they're playing this and it sounds that way, I guess, is intentional. And it sounds really good. At 3:26, the layers start to build on it, which I really like, and then it changes up a little bit, like the vocal changes a little bit, the riff changes. So that obviously then segs into the last track, which is All Mixed Up.
Some things that I say to her just don't seem to bite. It's all mixed up. It's all mixed up. It's all mixed up. Tricks me in
mixed up. It's all mixed up.
Don't know what to do. Oh no, that's the wrong "all mixed up." Sorry. this song, there all the elements in this song. I really, really enjoy. Some real interesting stuff in here. It's just for the 4 minutes. This is almost, again, to what we've been talking about, taken as a whole musical piece. This is a very nice ending to that, and a very essential part. As an individual song, it's not really so much a song. It's more of a sound to me, which is not necessarily a bad thing. It's just, to me, this isn't a standalone track. This belongs with the tracks preceding it. But I mean, there's so many great elements in this, and it's a really nice way to close out the album and the album side. It's still a winner for me, even though I can't listen to it individually. It has to be with the others.
I never would have guessed an album could be new wave, hard rock, and concept at the same time, but here we are. This is a storyteller of a song and one of the better codas to an album that I can remember. Maybe a little too Electric Light Orchestra for my liking, but that was the sound of the day, so I can't say I'm surprised. You can never have too much saxophone in a song. You can have too much synthesizer. And by this point in the record, I'm getting over it. But hey, that's what makes it one of the definitive founding works of New Wave. I'm a little mixed on "All Mixed Up," but at least I'm not in touch with your world.
Oh, dear.
That's a good pun.
Yeah, Sean, I'm showing you the yellow card, okay?
This is my cheers.
Thank you, Jason. Thank you.
Well done.
Considering this is the only saxophone solo in the Cars discography, has to speak volumes, because I guess they weren't a band that wanted to go the saxophone route. But when you listen to this... Greg Hawkes nails it. It's a fantastic solo. It's got soul. It's got emotion. And it's weird. As, like Sean said, being the coda of the album, it ties in all the stuff that we've listened to over 9 tracks in almost this Broadway-esque closure of the album. And it's almost all coming together, a little bit of the weirdness, a little bit of the rock. And then here's the saxophone out of left field. Why? Because we can, and because it works. I can't hear a saxophone on Heartbeat City. I can't hear it on Panorama. And I really can't hear a saxophone on any of their other songs in their discography. But for some reason, I can't hear "All Mixed Up" without it.
I feel like it was almost like maybe like Greg Hawkes' mom was like, you know, I paid for those saxophone lessons when you were a kid. God damn it. You're going to use them and get him on this record.
Yeah. Just give me one. Just give me one song with a saxophone.
Yeah. And then this was the last song they recorded. They're like, damn it. We should have done that more.
The Cars get saxy.
So the intro to this song, one of the things that is a little abrasive to me, is it a ride cymbal where he's just tink, 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 tinking on that.
Yeah.
It's a little much for me, but I like how the layers build into it. And I like basically by 1:45, everything kicks in and it's a nice little groove. And I completely agree. The way that the sax leads this album out, I don't know what that's an ode to. Like, what are they? A lot of times when the last track on an album is, you're kind of like going, this is where we're going, but they never did it again. So it wasn't that. But it was awesome. So this is not one of my favorite songs on the record, but it finishes off that second side, complete masterpiece that I think is a perfect album side. And as part of that, I think it works. The vocal for me is a little rough in this, but I like when the backing vocals build into it. So I can deal with it. I think it's a good way to end the track. And I think that sax solo absolutely is killer
on the demo version. If you get the deluxe edition, actually Rick sings it, So if you want to hear something a little different.
That's interesting. I'd never heard that.
All right. Now that the track by track has been done, we're going to give the album our final thoughts and album ratings. For our new listeners, the album rating is a 0 to 5 scale, where a 5 is a favorite of ours, and where a 0, all right, well, a 0 sucks, and I'll add in whatever it is.
How later. About it's just what you didn't need?
So there you go. Where a 5 is a favorite of ours, and a 0 is just what you didn't need. Brian, what do you think?
I don't even think I have to say it's obviously a 5. It's my favorite album of all time. It ushered in an entire genre of music that would be capitalized upon for close to the next decade. I'd say new wave maybe around 86 started to kind of fade out of the public eye, but that's a movement. And to be able to be one of the ignition points of that movement speaks volumes. And I think this album is iconic in a lot of different ways. And it's not often you could say that you're a pioneer in a musical genre. And it gets less and less as music tastes get more and more refined. And this was one where they're like, sure, punk, pop, rock, power pop, 50s, psychedelic. Let's just throw it into a pot and make a smorgasbord here. And that's what the car self-titled is.
The Cars seem to have caught lightning in a bottle with this. One track aside, it's albums like this that make me glad we do this show. This was my first listen all the way through. Something that holds the entire record up is an excellent rhythm section. The drums and bass are some of the tightest you'll hear on a rock album. Take the penultimate track, Moving in Stereo, as just one example. The kick and the downstroke on the bass are like the same person, tied at the hip at least. There's examples of this all throughout the record, when the rhythm section is in the pocket like that, and it feeds the rest of the band. When playing live, it can make or break a number. I talked at the top of the show about gravity and experience. The Cars, even though it's a debut, sound like they've already worked through some of the tweaks that most bands do to find their sound. I forget often that this is a debut album. It sounds like seasoned vets laying down their fourth or fifth record. Put the Cars up there with the likes of REM or David Bowie as game-changing bands or artists that salvaged what they could from rock after the late 70s chewed it up and spit it out. I rarely give anything above a 4 for a record. This is a solid, solid 4.
As I mentioned at the top of the at the program, this is a greatest hits record without being a greatest hits record. And to me, every song on the self-titled album is indispensable from the album and indispensable from the other songs around it. And that's very rare to find an album like that. I mean, it's almost, you would almost call it a perfect album. So that paired with the fact that up until this point in the 70s, you know, you had people using synthesizers, bands like Yes, Emerson, Lake and Palmer, doing prog things using synthesizers and keyboards. And along comes the Cars to, I can't think of anybody before them that said, let's take those elements and apply them into a rock, you know, pop concept and come up with this whole new thing. And they're pioneers for that. And this is almost a blueprint for doing that correctly. And this is the first time this has happened in any album I've discussed on this, but I'm going to give this a 5.
Hey, in 1978, the Cars released this record, and it was basically the defining moment in the new thing that was called the new wave. And for me personally, as a look back guy, because I did not grow up, I was born in 1978. So this isn't something I grew up with. And as is well documented in the course of our reviews here, like a lot of the records that I come across that are old 70s or 80s records are a lot of times my gateway is through covers. Same with this track, right? So like I got to this through covers. I got through Led Zeppelin through covers. And when you pull up a record like this and you put it on and you listen to it from front to back, what I realize is like, number one, I'm surprised at how familiar I am with these songs. Even though I never listened to this record before front to back, I knew half the songs on the record already. It was one of the things I texted Sean when I was like, you should do this review. I promise you, you've heard 2/3 of the songs already. And then
I did. You were right.
Yeah. And then, but you don't realize they're all in one record, right? And then you listen to the record in sequence and it gives you, it's pretty amazing when you think about debut records and the accomplishments that they can hit where when you're listening from a record front to back and you go, I know that song. I know that. I've never listened to the Cars in my life. I know that song. 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 And it's their debut record. That's pretty impressive. Now, I'm not a big new wave fan. In general, this genre is not exactly what tickles me. It's not my favorite. But what I found my experience with listening to this record, and I'm going to challenge the listeners to do the same thing. If you just sit down and listen to this record, and you go, I'm not a new wave fan. I'm not going to like this record. But if you're a guitar rock fan, you'll be surprised how much you might like this record. Because it's a guitar rock record disguised as a new wave record. Sit down and listen to it front to back. It's a more enjoyable experience than you think. If I think about what I've rated the other records we've done so far, I can't put this in my top tier of my favorite records I've ever been, but this was a super enjoyable experience to listen to. I'm going to give it a 3.5. It probably could be a 4 if I get more familiar with it, which I just have not been. But I'm going to tell the listeners, sit down, press play on this record, listen to it front to back. You will not be disappointed. Put your headphones on, enjoy all the nuances in there. It's a good time sitting and listening to this record.
Well, in another 6 years, we'll review it for a third time and see where you're at there.
There you go. All right. So thank you very much, Brian Colburn, for joining us from My Weekly Mixtape. Brian, tell us about your podcast, your concept, and what the listeners can dig into.
Well, My Weekly Mixtape is basically a fantasy football concept applied to music. I was born in 1977, so I grew up with cassette tapes. And as I was growing up, my obsession was recording songs off the radio, which pivoted into when I got my first dubber, recording songs off other cassettes and cassette singles. And then when I got a CD player, taking songs from the radio and cassette singles and CDs and putting them onto a cassette to bring with me for road trips, just for It's Friday. I always was making mixtapes. And my buddies and I, if we were going out on a Saturday night, we'd get together Saturday afternoon and put together a mixtape to listen to that night because you had to. And there was a lot of fun sitting down and saying, let's put this song next. No, let's try this one. This will work better here. And you'd go back and forth and kind of have that conversation. And that was such a fun time in my life growing up that I decided to revisit it with this show, because when you make playlists, sometimes you mindlessly just drag 100 songs into a list and hit shuffle and the sequencing goes away. But when you were a kid and you knew you had to spend the length of each song listening to it in real time, you put more thought into it. If I send my wife a playlist, it's, oh, that's nice, dear. And she'll just keep scrolling. But if I made a cassette where I spent 3 hours putting these songs together in a specific sequence and writing down things, and you put that heart into it, somebody was a little bit more open to listen. So I'm trying to bring that back, that at least that mindset, into playlisting. I don't expect people to actually make mixtapes, but it's called My Weekly Mixtape, a playlist curation podcast, because I want to make people think about the songs they're putting in order. And through those discussions, I'm hoping that people stop dragging and hitting random and start thinking, wow, this song actually tells my story when you listen to them back to back, or this tells a better story for an artist or a topic. And that's what I try to bring each week to the podcast.
I listened to your episode with Jax Hollow recently, your blues episode. It was a show that was very well done and great to expand beyond just traditional, you know, classic rock, which we talk about here a lot on this show. Yeah. But well done. Great show. Hope everybody checks it out.
I appreciate that. And if anybody wants to, it's very easy. Just search My Weekly Mixtape wherever you listen to podcasts, or myweeklymixtape.com. If you add me on social, I'm a one-man operation. So find me on social at My Weekly Mixtape and connect. I'd love to talk music. And it's basically, it's a positive show like this. We're celebrating albums and music that we grew up loving or that's brand new that we fell in love with. Because the show has, it's not really tied to a genre, every week is a little something different. So it's really geared towards hardcore music fans that want to hear a little bit of everything, but there's a little something for everybody in the mix.
Brian, you're doing a great job, and we're supporters of you here, and super glad that you could be here with us.
I appreciate you guys letting me come on and talk music with you. An open invite to the three is anytime you want to come on and build a mixtape with me, I'd love to have you.
It's awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Careful what you wish for.
Amen.
You just might get it.
Hillman will be coming in. That's what they said to
me. That's what they said to me on this show, and here I am, kicking themselves ever since.
Amen. All right. For the R4 podcast, I've been Jason Donsis.
I am Ian Rice.
I'm Sean Hillman.
See ya.
See ya.
The Ridiculous Rock Records Review Podcast is hosted by Jason Donsis, David Hudson, Sean Hillman, and Ian Rice. Show produced and directed by Jason Donsis. Logo by David Hall. Theme music from the Steepwater Band. Find them online at steepwater.com. If you have questions, comments, feedback, or ideas for the show, or just want to connect, find us on your favorite social media platform at R4 Podcaster, or email us at ridiculousrockrecords@gmail.com. The R4 Podcast was created by Aaron Martell. Thank you for dropping the needle with us. Until next time, rock on.
Wow, we almost got the sign off right that time.
Yeah, well, it's better than Dave's.
Only took us 2.5 months to doing the show.
My buddy and I had a podcast for 3 years together, Jay Sweet. He comes on my show a lot. Mm-hmm. And we always ended our first show together saying, stay tuned, because it was called Tune Styles.
Oh.
And we were sitting directly across from each other. I'd be like, until next time. And we'd be like, stay tuned.
Stay tuned.
Yeah. 80 episodes, we never got it right.
We don't really care. We're not that professional.
No, that's apparent. We have a good time doing it, though. Good feedback on the show so far.
Yeah, it's been fun.
Excuse me, gentlemen. I am a professional. I have another podcast, okay?
Oh, my God. Here we go.